Welcome to everybody to our Wednesday evening seminar. Can I ask first if there are any announcements? No? Okay. In which case, my name is Michael Hand. I'm a member of staff here at the Institute and I'll be chairing the seminar this evening. I'm delighted to introduce our speaker today. Rupert Reed is Reader in Philosophy at the University of East Anglia. He's coordinator for the Eastern Region of the Green Party and was himself very recently a Green Party city councillor in Norwich. His research interests are in the philosophy of language, the philosophy of science, and environmental philosophy. And his books include Philosophy for Life, Applying Philosophy in Politics and Culture, The New Wittgenstein, and most recently, Beyond the Tractatus Wars, The New Wittgenstein Debate. That's in the shops right now, published in August 2011.
Very reasonable prices.
Very reasonably priced, yes.
Paperback.
And his paper this evening is entitled Wittgenstein's Therapeutic Conception of Philosophy as a Challenge to Standard Understandings of What Knowledge Must Be.
Thank you, Michael. And thanks also to Paul and to Jade and to everyone for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. I'll just start out by very briefly following up what Michael kindly said there by mentioning that my new book, Beyond the Tractatus Wars, is partly about the idea of pushing a therapeutic reading of the early Wittgenstein. I'm mostly going to be talking today and drawing from the later Wittgenstein, but my belief is that Wittgenstein throughout his career was a therapeutic thinker, and that gets expressed, for example, in my own essay in that book. Some other works I'm going to be referring to in today's talk, I've written up on the marker board there, in case anyone wants to note down the details of them. So that's just about everything that I'll be referring to. My belief is that every one of those books that I've written down up there that I'll be mentioning is extremely good and important, and that's why I'm going to be referring to them. I'm not going to be criticizing people much today. I'm just going to be basically trying to put forward a series of thoughts for you and that we can talk about, and these thoughts are I think, good thoughts, and they are due to Wittgenstein, obviously, but also to these various people whose names I've written on the board there. And then at the bottom, just mentioning a couple of my books that are relevant, including my book, Wittgenstein Among the Sciences, which will soon be coming out in a couple months' time, and this talk today in part draws upon material that's going to be in that book. So in this talk today, I'm going to be exploring the way in which a Wittgensteinian therapeutic or liberatory vision of philosophy changes radically our understanding of what kind of knowledge, if any, a philosopher has, and what kind of expertise, if any, she has. And I'm going to be exploring the consequences of this, including outside of philosophy. And I think, I hope you'll hear a kind of implicit philosophy of education throughout everything that I have to say this afternoon. What I'm talking about is a way of understanding knowledge, learning, thinking, which truly breaks with scientism. So Wittgenstein's philosophy is, in my understanding of it, a philosophy, as I like to call it, of unknowing. In this sense, Wittgenstein, I believe, realizes the promise that was not delivered upon in the best of the ancient skeptics, the promise to keep seeking, and more famously, the promise that was also not delivered upon in Socrates, the promise that Socrates made when he claimed not to know anything. Also, the promise that Socrates made when he emphasized the importance of knowing thyself. Because I'm going to be suggesting implicitly and at moments explicitly in what follows that philosophical knowledge is a kind of self-knowledge, but that self-knowledge is, roughly speaking, not a kind of knowledge. So if we think about knowledge as we know it, and then we think about self-knowledge, I'm going to be suggesting that really self-knowledge, although it looks like it's a kind of knowledge, it's a sort of subspecies of this, that it really isn't. Okay. What I'm going to be saying is also, I think, although I'm not going to be talking about this explicitly, close to some traditions of Buddhism, including Zen Buddhism, because I'm going to be urging that we free ourselves from attachment to dogma by means of acknowledging other possibilities. This, as I understand it, is the core of what the later works of Gordon Baker, whose name I should have put up there actually, one of the great therapeutic readers of Wittgenstein, believes, and I follow him in this. And this, I believe, is enlightenment in its true sense in philosophy. So a couple of questions about what I've said so far. Why is the kind of thing I'm talking about here so difficult to do? Because I think it is difficult to do. And why does it encounter such resistance as a project in the academic world? A key reason in response to both these questions is, I think, scientism. Because doing the kind of thing I've started to talk about here goes against the grain. And that requires courage, a willingness to do different as well as to think different. And to give you an idea of what the problems are that we're grappling with here, I'd like you to turn, please, to your handout. Hope everyone's got a handout. There should be plenty of them around the room. Paul has one if you don't have one. To turn to the first quote on the handout. These are all quotes from Wittgenstein. Science, enrichment and impoverishment. The one method elbows all others aside. Compared with this, they all seem paltry, preliminary stages at best. This is crucial. My view is that to avoid a new dark age, a dark age which would appear superficially to be an age of enlightenment and which would be all the more dangerous for that, we need to keep alive the thought that there can be a method beside or beyond the scientific method, a method or methods that has some legitimacy, some real difference. A great candidate for this is the idea of therapy, about which I sent around before today a paper which hopefully some of you had a chance to read. I should stress that was background reading for today's talk, not the actual talk that I'm giving here. The idea of therapy we can trace back to some degree to Socrates, to the Pyrrhonists, to the Stoics. But if we turn to modern times, then it's most obvious to trace it back to Freud. Freud himself, of course, was in many ways a hopelessly scientistic thinker, as Wittgenstein points out in some detail. But Wittgenstein, I think, also delivers on the promise, again unfulfilled, failed, of Freud, to be able to give us something new, something which isn't just scientism, therapy. This is why Wittgenstein called himself a disciple of Freud. What therapy gives us, which is not present in scientism, is a new criterion for truth. Truth as judged by the patient themselves, leading to them, hopefully, getting better to health. Acknowledgement by the patient, not imposition by an external, scientifically authoritative doctor. The cure of truth, as it's sometimes called. But truth here isn't truth without acknowledgement. So the criterion is that you haven't got the patient's problem right unless the patient themselves acknowledges that you've got it right. And there's nothing like this in science as it's normally practiced. You don't require the acknowledgement of atoms or plants or anything else to be sure that your theories about them are on the right track. So the great challenge for us here as philosophers, the difficulty confronting us as we seek to take up the possibility of therapy, is humility. Being willing to give up the prop of quasi-scientific expertise. This is what scientific philosophers who dominate our discipline, philosophers from Davidson to Fodor, from Dummett to Rawls, are unwilling to do. For not only can we not claim expertise, but as part of this, the therapist always has to be in therapy himself. And again, here, drawing ideas from originally psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. But in order to think beyond some of the things that Freud and his successors got hopelessly wrong, it's sometimes useful also to remind ourselves of some of the developments that have come since the days of Freud in psychoanalysis, in psychotherapy, in counseling, which themselves point more directly in this direction. So, for example, the idea of Sandor Ferenczi, of what he called, mutual therapy. Ferenczi's idea was that, or mutual analysis. Ferenczi's idea was that he would analyze the patient for 50 minutes, and then the patient would analyze him for 50 minutes. They swapped around. And the same principle is found in modern-day co-counseling. So therapy isn't then something that I do to you. It starts with me doing it to me, as in Freud's great self-analysis, which is fascinatingly revealed, for example, in the early portions of the interpretation of dreams. Psychoanalysis basically begins with Freud analyzing his own dreams about the beginnings of psychoanalysis. And Wittgenstein's take on this was expressed, for example, in his lovely remark that everything I write is, as it were, a conversation that I have tête-à-tête with myself. So it starts with me doing it to myself, and then it's you and I doing it together. And I have to be open to the possibility that it continues to be me rather than you who is more in need of therapy. I'll come back to this point. Now, if one looks at the methodology of science, one finds, of course, elements such as hypothesizing and theory building. It seems to me that these things are not particularly characteristic of philosophy, at least as Wittgenstein wants us to understand philosophy. Wittgenstein is in search of a mode of philosophizing that has integrity, a conception of philosophy in which it is not reducible to science, or for that matter, to maths. He asks what philosophy can then be. Philosophical thinking is, of course, sometimes close, in some respects, to what is going on in science at moments of rupture, at moments involving extraordinary reflection and the conceptualization of new possibilities, as Kuhn describes it. But the fundamental nature of philosophy, the fundament of the philosophical method for Wittgenstein, as I understand him, is roughly therapeutic. It's not about trying to build theories and to test theories by experimentation, not about arguing for one theory and opposing others. What therapeutic philosophy is about is reflection upon the presuppositions that one oneself makes in any such activity. In terms of thinking about what we take to be science, for instance, it would be, for instance, reflecting upon what Kuhn calls our paradigm. This is something that scientists normally virtually never do, because they virtually never need to do so. They, as it were, look right through their paradigms. They are transparent to them. In the kind of way focal to the work of Lakoff and Johnson in relation to metaphor, Lakoff and Johnson make a terribly important point, I think, when they point out how we tend to, and generally need to, look right through our metaphors. If you're always noticing your metaphors, as for example some poets do, then you can't get anything very much done. But this kind of noticing, not just looking through as if our way of speaking is transparent, is, as I understand it, the quintessential activity of philosophy. And this is necessarily therapeutic, because it involves making figural and even putting into question those presuppositions that one holds most dear, and perhaps coming to awareness of some presuppositions which one hadn't noticed one held to at all. This is another of the inspirations that Wittgenstein takes from Freud, a concern with those aspects of one's thinking and one's presumptions that are unconscious. So, the process is a therapeutic one in the following way. One is trying to help oneself, or one's reader, or one's interlocutor, to gain clarity by subjecting to scrutiny what are potentially, and perhaps in some sense unconsciously, one's most fundamental assumptions. This is analogous in relevant respects to the method of the therapist helping a client to bring to consciousness certain background conditions or assumptions which they may not even have been aware of. A crucial feature of this analogy is, as I've already suggested, that unless the client is willing to acknowledge what the therapist is trying to draw attention to, the therapist ultimately has no good grounds for asserting that it is in fact there. And this again is the point about the non-hierarchical nature of therapy, as we are here being urged to understand it. So, no hierarchical position of authority or expertise here. I am not saying, as a Wittgensteinian philosophical therapist, that I know what your or whoever's problems are and I know that I can solve them. And this, I think, is the point at which many would-be Wittgensteinians err, including, for example, the influential tradition of Peter Hacker and his students. Our method in philosophy is rather an attempt to enter into a dialogue with certain essential aspects and assumptions underlying, for instance, the disciplines which one is perhaps trying to understand better, and to see if one can find a way of appreciating, interrogating, perhaps verbally rearranging them in such a way that their own practitioners will come to realize that what is being said about them is right. Of course, to say it again, if the practitioners come to no such realization, one has no good grounds ultimately for asserting that it is right. This is one of the important ways in which clarity requires charity. This is something which Peter Winch in particular clearly understood. The therapy which one is trying to practice has to be a genuinely dialogical and collaborative enterprise. So, in therapeutic philosophy, as I understand and aim to practice it, the onus is on the reader or interlocutor to attain a position of self-awareness and clarity regarding the impulse to raise particular philosophical questions, or to see things in a particular way, or to call things by particular names, and so on. by means of a process of self-interrogation. The aim of such a self-interrogation would be liberation from the view that such and such must be the case. Therapeutic philosophy then can be described in Kantian terms as a matter of coming to a position of autonomy rather than heteronomy, by virtue of, and slightly more specifically, Wittgensteinian terms, no longer being held captive by pictures which insist that such and such must be the case. Such pictures may, for example, suggest that a particular human science must be modelled on the natural sciences in order to be worthwhile, or to yield interesting or fruitful results, to the exclusion of other possibilities. So it's implicit in what I'm saying here, that the view of therapy being taken here is as a process which enables a person to help herself gain clarity, increase self-understanding, and achieve greater freedom. In some important respects, this is a transformed remainder of the epistemically optimistic Enlightenment project, once some of the darkness triumphant of that project in its actually existing form has been overcome. Of course, the way in which therapy and philosophy as therapy can increase and deepen our knowledge is then not at all the same way in which scientific investigations enlarge or deepen our knowledge. Therapeutic epistemology is irreducibly an affective, as well as an intellectual process. And as Wittgenstein stressed, it's a matter of will and courage, not just of intellect. The fundamental conception of this talk, then, is to introduce a therapeutic, liberatory, Wittgensteinian spirit into a reflection on the methodology of various disciplines, including philosophy itself. Wittgenstein has been widely misunderstood as hostile to science. What he was, in fact, hostile to is only scientism. Scientism imagines that all of science, and ultimately all of whatever can be understood or explained, can be explained via the so-called scientific method. The scientific approach approaches the world like we sometimes imagine an alien would, as completely alien, as needing to be exhaustively categorized in terms we cannot anticipate a priori. Now, there is something right about this, so far as it concerns science. It captures an aspect of normal science, the relentless effort to categorize and explain. And it captures also an aspect of revolutionary science, the strangeness at root of the new world that's presented to us by a Copernicus, a Galileo, a Lavoisier, an Einstein, or a Planck. It's strikingly wrong as a would-be approach to the process of understanding science itself. Here, we have to apply historical and hermeneutic, etc. methods. Analogously, the scientific approach is wrong for the subject matter of the so-called human sciences, for everything that isn't a real science. The approach in their case should be, roughly speaking, from the inside, via familiarity of an appropriate kind, which may, as Peter Winch in particular emphasized, take some finding. In relation to human studies, then, the strange is only what won't fit yet with what we already know. This can sound strikingly similar to the enterprise of normal science, but there is a vast difference, to which, for example, Ian McGilchrist is particularly attuned in his wonderful recent book, The Master and His Emissary. For the knowledge we already have in the case of the human world is in turn knowledge from the inside, knowledge we inhabit. Knowledge of the living as by one of the living. Knowledge which isn't overly knowing. Knowledge which lacks knowingness. And Kuhn and Winch, I would suggest, manifest a wonderful lack of knowingness. By contrast, scientism and postmodernism alike are horrifically knowing. I'll come back to this point. So this is what I seek to emphasize periodically in this talk. Let me now seek to re-emphasize it by saying a word about the politics of social or human science. And I'm going to give here a quote from a recent article by Timo Jutten on Adorno and Kant. And here's what Jutten says. Quote, I can think of two ways in which Adorno might have developed his analysis, his critique of Kant, into a phenomenology of defective self-conceptions. These ways examine what happens when modern subjects make theoretical reason authoritative over themselves or over others. In the first case, I have a form of self-reification in mind. Here, the subject is conceived as a detective who possesses privileged knowledge of his own desires and feelings because he has undertaken a search in his own mental world and discovered these desires and feelings. This is self-knowledge in this defective sense that I mentioned earlier, viewed as if a subcategory of knowledge in general. As Adorno points out, in pathological cases, which are neurotic, or indeed, we may add, psychotic, the subject experiences its own unfreedom when it cannot identify with its own true inner nature. In the second case, I have the attitude in mind that we take towards others when we consider them from the standpoint of theoretical reason. As Peter Strawson has pointed out, when we take such an objective attitude toward others, or treat them as objects of social policy, then we evaluate their conduct in terms of causal explanations rather than in terms of freely chosen intentions. Clearly, if theoretical reason becomes authoritative over us in either of these ways, our self-relation and social relations will be severely damaged, and the pathology of this damage will be traceable, and I think this is a very nice conclusion that Justin draws here, will be traceable to the need to dominate nature in the first place. I would like to broadly embrace the analysis that Justin has made here in the quote I've just given. What I think is particularly striking about it is this. The first case of self-reification reflects what Louis Sass, for example, has argued at length in his wonderful book, Madness and Modernism, that there are extensive instances available of such psychical self-reification in the literature, for example, on schizophrenia, especially in cases of paranoid schizophrenia, of Langian divided selves, etc. In other words, this important form of self-reification is a natural result of some forms of psychosis and perhaps of certain forms of neurosis. While the second case, a reification of others, reflects, as Jutten explicates or implies, the mode of being in the world typical of social policy, of social science, of psychology and psychiatry considered as sciences. And these two cases are two sides of the same coin, broadly the same attitude applied first to the self or then to others. Do you see where I'm heading with this? The very attitude that philosophically informed reflection can help us to see is of the essence of various psychopathological phenomena when directed onto oneself, is the attitude that social or human or psychological science recommends one take up with regard to others. The scientific study of the mind of the other mirrors the very pathology that it aims to explain. I want to give now an important instance of this, which I think can be found in so-called theory of mind theory for allegedly explaining autism. Theory of mind theory aims to explain what it is that autists, persons with autism, are missing, what's missing in them. They don't have a theory of mind, allegedly. But in the course of doing so, what it actually attributes to normals, to you and I, or probably most people in this room, is the very thing that autists seek to develop to replace what it is they are actually missing, an easiness at being in the world, the normal affordances of the world, etc. Theory of mind theory says that normals have such a theory. But that is to make all normals into brilliantly coping autists, rather than to characterize adequately the difference between normals and autists. Claiming that we all have a theory of mind theory that autists lack, and that the grasp of this theory by scientific psychologists is the scientific progress enabling us to see this, is to place all of us, normals, autists, and psychologists, on the autism side of the autism spectrum. To put the point just slightly polemically, theory of mind theory is exactly the kind of theory of mind that one would expect a high-functioning autist rather than a properly right-brained normal to come up with. Its wide acceptance indicates something deep in my view about how right Ian McGilchrist is in what he says about the extent to which more or less autistic left-brain scientism has overtaken our culture, including our politics, and also about how deep Wittgenstein's worries about the tendency of scientific thinking to lead us to pathologically overgeneralize and reify, about how deep these cut. Theory of mind theory is a heightened and subterranean form of the very disease, i.e. autism, of which it takes itself to be the explanation and cure. To generalize, social, human, and psychological science is an expression of such pathology, and such pathology can only be understood, if at all, only from a different basis, from that of such science, the kind of basis that I have endeavored to examine and to offer a fragment of so far here. To approach the human world predominantly from such a pathological perspective is to approach it like an alien, like an anthropologist from a Mars that machines, rather than men, little green men or whatever kind of men, are from. This, if true, is a remarkable and worrying finding. So, the difference between ordinary scientific understanding and the kind of understanding characteristic of the human studies is not exactly a difference in subject matter. It's more a matter of subjects as opposed to objects. And subjects are not a subject matter. They demand a different way, a different how. What does that mean? We are inevitably in the domain of metaphors here, a domain which cannot be escaped without violence being done to the phenomena, without over-literalization. We are in the domain of what Wittgenstein called objects of comparison, the domain of therapy. From what McGilchrist calls an overly left-brain perspective, this is endlessly unsatisfying. From a right-brain perspective, it is inevitable. The urge to make the inexplicit explicit, the urge to escape from metaphor, is the endless urge of McGilchrist's scientistic left brain, also, incidentally, of the pornographer. Making explicit can reduce or crudify or indeed destroy the very phenomena it means to capture. And the word capture, I think, is already a worrying word in this context. We need to be worried every time we're inclined to use it. In the academy and in the world at large, theorizing and most forms of explanation may indeed be on the ascendant. Theorism and scientism run rampant. Their models clearly rule the academy. Look, for instance, at the way that all funding councils are modeled on science funding councils. Look at the way that the catch-all term research so patently ill-fits many of the humanities, such as, to give an extreme example, creative writing. Look at the way that scientism still continues to dominate economics despite the absolutely catastrophic events of the last few years, which literally only one economist in the whole world predicted. This is a castle built on quicksand outside of its natural home. Why? Well, in the end, it's a question of logical priority. Theorizing as an activity is in some respects a natural language pursuit, and is inevitably the more so the less it is reducible to maths, and the more its would-be subject matter is subjects. Unless the theorizing loses any tether to socio-human reality, as happens sometimes in, for instance, contemporary economics, in which case it reverts to being simply something like applied maths. Theorizing employs linguistic resources, many of which have not yet been clarified, have not had their logical grammars made explicit and analyzed. Until the resources taken from our manifold metaphorical systems of conceptualizing, inevitably manifesting or parasitic on the concepts actually used by members of a culture, the methods of the people. Until the resources used by theorizers are treated as topics for explicit attention rather than as unexamined, unexplicated, taken for granted resources, theories cannot be expected to be coherent and will always rely on and be compromised by the largely unknown properties of those resources. Even if one sees it as a valid objective to theorize, which obviously I tend to be skeptical of in relation to the human sciences, let alone in relation to the humanities proper, theorists remain in need of Wittgensteinian clarifications, etc. And Wittgensteinian clarification is not just a matter of definition of terms, but is an examination and investigation of the linguistic resources that actually shape philosophical, etc. theories. And this again is an insight that is very strongly present in the great work of Lakoff and Johnson, as well as in ethnomethodology. Of course, once more, so I'm not misunderstood, none of this implies that there cannot be science proper, nor even that our idea of the epistemological status of actual science needs radically revising at all. The scientific theorizing, genuine scientific theorizing, is, as Wittgenstein put it, capable of undergirding new uses of words, provided, of course, that the theory in question is well attested, in ways that philosophical, etc., theorizing is not. And turn on this point, if you would, please, to number 2 on your handout. Again, from Wittgenstein's Culture and Value. In a scientific perspective, a new use is justified by a theory. And if the theory is false, the new extended use of a word Wittgenstein is talking about here, has to be given up. But in philosophy, the extended use does not rest on true or false beliefs about natural processes. No fact justifies it. None can give it any support. And this is how we ought to be always nervous of any novel and unsupported use of terms that philosophers resort to, as they continually do. So the kind of thing that we do finds therapy a happier object of comparison than theory. As I implied earlier, a crucial way in which my work is intended to be therapeutic is that it is not aimed to impose upon the reader or the listener. Expertise in social understanding is in the first instance a maturational art, not a science open to expertise in any academic sense of the word. And here I'm thinking again in relation to my title for today's talk, Wittgenstein's Therapeutic Conception of Philosophy as a Challenge to Standard Understandings of What Knowledge Must Be, of what McGilchrist gives us in his wonderful book, A Radical Critique of Knowingness, a critique, for instance, of scientistic thinkers, whether you're talking about Dawkins or Sokal or Giddens or Bhaskar or their ilk in the so-called social sciences, or of postmodern thinkers. Postmodern thinkers who think that there is no outside to theory, who think there's no possibility of anything genuinely new under the sun. Postmodern thinkers think they're being anti-scientistic, but they are actually just scientistic in its most subterranean form, and thus more thoroughly dangerous even than outright scientistic thinkers who admit their scientism. What's the alternative? The alternative is, as I mentioned at the start, what I like to call a philosophy of unknowing. A philosophy that, for example, when it is interested, as it is profoundly interested, in experience, is interested in the true quiddities of experience, not in empiricism, and that manifests the kinds of openness to what Zen calls beginner's mind, a genuine openness to the new. And that is manifested in what Wittgenstein calls knowing one's way about. I'll give you a splendid quote on this from some of Wittgenstein's lectures. Very apposite given where we're sitting right now. In teaching you philosophy, I'm like a guide showing you how to find your way around London. I have to take you through the city from north to south, from east to west, from Euston to the Embankment, and from Piccadilly to the Marble Arch. After I've taken you many journeys through the city in all sorts of directions, we shall have passed through any given street a number of times, each time traversing the street as part of a different journey. At the end of this, you will know London. You will be able to find your way about like a born Londoner. Or like a taxi driver who has the knowledge, but perhaps has never even used a map or wouldn't even know how to use one. And finally, we can use the idea of skill or art rather than the idea of science. And this idea is pushed in a beautiful way by the very important work of Hubert Dreyfus in this area. I want to give you a couple of quick quotes on what Dreyfus has to say about this. And these quotes are taken from Bent Flifberg's wonderful book, Making Social Science Matter, which again is listed on the sheet over there. So firstly, a quote from Flifberg about what it is that Dreyfus is trying to do in his crucial ideas about science and art, and how this relates to the so-called social or human sciences, including so-called educational theory. The problem in the study of human activity is that every attempt at a context-free definition of an action, that is, a definition based on abstract rules or laws, will not necessarily accord with the pragmatic way an action is defined by the actors in a concrete social situation. Social scientists do not have a theory, rules and laws, for how the people they study determine what counts as an action, because the determination derives from situationally defined, context-dependent skills, which the objects of study are proficient and experts in exercising, and because theory, by definition, presupposes context independence. And another quote from a little later in Flitterbird's book. The core of the argument of Dreyfus along these lines is that human activity cannot be reduced to a set of rules, and without rules, there can be no theory. Dreyfus formulates the point as follows, a nested quote from Dreyfus. In some cases, our basic social skills may have been acquired by consciously following rules defined over elements, but like any skill which has reached a level of mastery, our ability to cope with everyday things and situations is no longer caused by and cannot be analyzed into the elements which went into its acquisition. Yet no one has found any other elements or is even trying to find them. You could relate this back to my point earlier about theory of mind theory. Theory of mind theory imagines that as one builds up a skill, the theory remains intact and keeps growing and growing as one builds up the skill, whereas the thought of Dreyfus is more like that any elements of theory that go into the building up of the skill are thrown away, as it were, as a ladder, as the skill becomes more genuinely acquired and, if you like, internalized. This, by the way, is, I think, why the project of strong AI fails. Because the project of strong AI has tried to proceed in exactly the manner that Dreyfus here criticizes. And this is also why I think the vast majority of so-called social science and social theory crudifies the phenomena that it aims to depict. So this is why there is and can be, I would suggest, no elite of experts in the genuine content of social and human science. And that's the risk that social science tends to crudify and reduce to an oversimplified unity what are actually sophisticated contrasts and variegated contextual understandings that are available to and made manifest in the practice of ordinary people in their everyday lives. The practice for ordinary members of society vis-à-vis reality is always already more sophisticated and reliable than theorizations of it made by philosophers and sociologists. This point is on my reading central to Peter Winch's work, just as it is implicitly manifest throughout Wittgenstein's work and also Harold Garfinkel's. Social science, usurping philosophy's role almost always yields something less subtle, less reliable, less, we might almost say, scientific than the deliberations and understandings of those who are its subjects, i.e. its objects. Thus, social science and non-therapeutic philosophy alike usurp and oversimplify or crudify the role of the competent member of society. In an important sense, we are all, and by we, I don't just mean the people in this room or the kind of people in this room, we are all experts in social and human science. As very roughly, we are all, or at any rate, most listeners to this talk, experts in the English language. For Winch, Wittgenstein and ethno-methodology alike, by utter contrast with mainstream philosophy and sociology, the closest there is to an expert in the field is an ordinary, broadly competent social and linguistic being. The social and human studies, I would submit, unlike the social and human sciences, not only begin but also end with non-academics, with competent members of a community. Social study is above all something that we do most of the time, we humans. Again, as McGilchrist's work makes wonderfully available, the humanities and human or social studies is, or are, heirs to a whole different way of seeing, hearing, being in the world than that recommended by any science. So, the therapeutic approach is one that aims to orient, to reorient, to elicit new possibilities, to offer warnings, not to produce supposed chains of reasoning that must bring all to the same quasi-factual conclusion. If I'm right in thinking that the approach manifested in this talk today is by and large ultimately what McGilchrist would think of as a right brain approach, then this is inevitable. The detailed scrutiny, the theory building, the fitting into preformed categories of the left brain is not the procedure of a Kuhn or a Wittgenstein, as is crystal clear to one ready to read with attention the preface and introduction to Kuhn's Structural Scientific Revolutions or the preface to Philosophical Investigations. The intention of this talk has not been to produce a series of arguments that compel assent, but to offer to one interested in receiving it some aids in considering the following two possibilities. First, that the human sciences ought not to be reduced to being sciences at all, and second, that instead there could be a different basis for intellectual human encounters with the human world. And now to finish off, I'd like to turn in this context to the remaining two quotations on your handout. So first, quotation number 3. A famous moment in Wittgenstein's introduction of the idea of so-called family resemblance concepts. The reason I wanted to put this on the handout is the wonderful emphasis I think this gives to the concept of experience as I would invite you to understand it or to re-understand it in the kind of way that Cora Diamond, following Wittgenstein, recommends as manifesting the realistic spirit, a willingness to engage with the quiddities of our world without theorizing it. I think it's such a remarkable moment when you have a philosopher like Wittgenstein saying, don't think, but look, and troubling to repeat it, such a surprising thing for a philosopher to say. And finally, quotation number 4, which you will notice is from Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, his early masterpiece. I wanted to put this here because 6.371 and 6.372 are one of the famous great moments of anti-scientism in Wittgenstein's Tractatus, where he says that there's a certain important sense in which ancient peoples were more advanced than modern peoples, in that they didn't give one the impression that everything was explained, which is the unfortunate impression given so often by science. Prior to this, we have 6.37, which is a terribly important passage. Runs as follows, immediately prior to that denunciation of scientism, we have this. A necessity for one thing to happen because another has happened does not exist. There is only logical necessity. This is a crucial therapeutic moment in the Tractatus, as has been emphasized famously by Cora Diamond. Because, and you can see this, because, for example, what one needs to do is to look carefully at the actual form of what Wittgenstein has written here. Look at the sentence, there is only logical necessity. So what this sentence seems to say is, there is only logical necessity as opposed to this other kind of necessity. So it seems as though it's saying, let me tell you what the facts are, it's one thing rather than another. But of course, if one understands what Wittgenstein is actually meaning to do here, what one comes to understand is that he's saying, no, the very idea of this other kind of necessity, there's something problematic with it. So, in fact, the statement that there is only logical necessity is itself, in a certain important sense, terminally misleading, because it always makes it sound as though there is one thing rather than another, whereas it means to be saying there is only this one thing. So the very statement, there is only logical necessity, is in a certain important sense condemned by its own utterance. This is the precise thing that Wittgenstein means when he says famously at the end of the Tractatus, that what one has to do if one's understanding his work, Wittgenstein's work, is to throw away the ladder. The sentence, there is only logical necessity, if you like, comes apart from what it means to be enabling you to understand. You have to abandon it if you were to continue with Wittgenstein on his journey. So the therapy disposes of the thing that that offers you the therapy, as well as the thing that it means to be criticizing. To use the wonderful metaphor that the ancient skeptics used, it's like a purgative. When you swallow the best kind of anti-diarrheal medicine, then it voids your bowels and it voids itself along with everything nasty that's in your bowels. So there is nothing left behind afterwards. Wittgenstein's therapeutic conception of philosophy is available for those who have ears throughout his writings, certainly from the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus onwards. It is, I submit, not particularly humbly, the greatest fruit yet on the tree of philosophy, for it enables us to see that tree as something other than a simple growth of one thing, knowledge. Thanks.
Excellent, thank you. I'm going to exercise the privilege of chair and ask the first question, if I may. I wonder, it's an attractive picture, but I'm wondering how it relates to the education of children. Who I take it are not yet what one might call ordinary, broadly competent human beings.
Yes.
That even if one went along with you to the extent of saying, along with Wittgenstein perhaps, we can only convict another person of a mistake if they acknowledge it as an expression of their mistake, and we can only determine the grammar of a language with the consent of the speaker of that language. The trouble is, kids aren't yet competent in the language, and they're not, and they may not be able to acknowledge mistakes, which are nevertheless real mistakes.
Yeah.
So is this the case for saying that we do still need educational theories? We do still need to theorise about the kind of mistakes children make, because we can't treat them yet as the sorts of experts that you're prepared to recognise the ordinary, broadly competent human being?
That's a really interesting question, a really important question. I'm not sure it does mean that. It might do. Here's why I'm not sure it does mean that. I think you're absolutely right that if we think, as it were, of people getting older on this axis, and the degree to which Wittgenstein's therapeutic conception of philosophy is applicable to them, it starts out that's on this axis. So age on one axis, Wittgenstein on the other. Then I take it the process is going to be, well, I'm not sure what the angle of the graph is, but it's going to go something like that. In other words, for very young children, it would clearly be completely ludicrous to say, well, unless the child acknowledges the truth of what I'm saying, then it's not true. The importance of this kind of vision of a kind of thing that knowledge can be, or an alternative vision of something radically different from what we're accustomed to thinking of, perhaps as knowledge, only starts to come to bear once there is a sufficient level of maturation, competence, etc., to be able to access it. But I'm not sure that implies what you said at the end in terms of, so doesn't that mean we need educational theory? Because, of course, educational theory is not something that you teach children, right? Educational theory is something that you teach these competent, mature, etc., students, adults, and so on and so forth. So the question would be, what's the argument that one actually needs to treat would-be teachers, for example, as if they were children? And I think it's an extremely questionable approach.
But then I think I meant something else by educational theory. One takes an educational theory to be a theory about children and their learning, a theory about how children learn.
A sort of developmental theory.
We have to theorise about children.
Yeah.
And that turns them into
that, which sounds scientific from your point of view, but it's difficult to see how we can avoid doing it.
Sorry, yes, okay, then we were talking somewhat across purposes. Yes, if by educational theory you mean a sort of developmental theory, then to some extent, absolutely, and I have absolutely no problem with that. If we're talking about, well, things such as, well, at certain ages children are not yet capable of certain kinds of abstraction, and so on and so forth, yeah, these are just, to a considerable extent, these are just simple, hard facts. Science is appropriate, psychology is appropriate, neurobiology is appropriate, etc. There's still a bit of a step, though. You see, what I was meaning by educational theory was going from that to questions of how one ought to teach. And of course, you can't read how you ought to teach directly off of that kind of genuinely scientific knowledge. Well, the genuinely scientific knowledge puts certain constraints on it, but it doesn't actually, it doesn't give you the answer to how one ought to teach. It puts certain constraints on it, as I see it.
One more clarification before I open up. I don't really mean developmental theories. Take, for example, there's a class of theorizing in education, which is about children's misconceptions in science. That a lot of science teachers start with the premise that the biggest impediment to children understanding scientific theories correctly is that they naturally form misconceptions. We have to diagnose the sorts of misconceptions that they form in order to correct them and give them the right conceptions. Now, that's not developmental theory. That's, you know, they're not, this isn't a developmental fact. It's the fact that there's something about their upbringing or...
Well, I take it is to a large extent a developmental fact, at least if it's true. I take it that it's based on ideas about the ways in which children are inclined, as a matter to some extent of biology, to certain kinds, for example, of anthropomorphism, and the way that that compose obstacles to scientific learning. The case of educational developmental theory in the teaching of science is, of course, a special case, because again, some of my objections to scientism are not going to apply, because what we're teaching people is precisely science. But again, even there you have to be careful, because, of course, actually quite a lot of the way that science, as I would see it, is likely to be most successfully taught is by itself being taught as a practice and not as, for example, a body of facts. So then once again we swing back to the kind of Dreyfus-type points and the skepticism as to the extent to which what one might think is an appropriately scientific method for the teaching of science is actually going to be workable and maximally effective.
Okay, thank you. Can I open up for questions? John?
We have one question about how far you think that people need to acknowledge truths about themselves for them to be truths about themselves. So it seems if you stuck really rigidly to that, then delusion would be impossible, and so would denial. But it seems that there are people who genuinely think they are the Messiah, and are deluded, but don't know that they're deluded, or they didn't think they were the Messiah. So that it seems there are things that you don't have to assent to be true about.
Yes, well, you'll have perhaps noticed that I did allow myself something of a sort of get-out clause by talking about psychopathology. I do think it's possible and actual for people to be deluded. I do think, however, you have to be extremely careful in making such a diagnosis. So to take your example, for example, I'm extremely hesitant before convicting any religious person of delusion, for the same reasons that Wittgenstein was extremely hesitant. Basically, Wittgenstein's view was it's almost impossibly difficult to get yourself into a position of being able to genuinely dialogue with somebody whose fundamental presuppositions in this kind of field are significantly different from one's own. So what Wittgenstein says in the lectures on religious belief over and over again is for the atheist and the theist to be able to contradict each other, it almost never actually happens. Over and over again, when the atheist explains to the theist what it is that they don't believe in, and the theist really succeeds in understanding that, then their response is, well, that wasn't what I meant to be talking about. You know, it wasn't an old man on a cloud with a white beard, etc. The only things you can rule out by means of characterizing certain religious beliefs as deluded are certain kinds of extreme literal forms of fundamentalism. And those things actually mirror scientism. Right, and that's again exactly what Wittgenstein said, that the problem with religion is when it gets into competition with science. And Wittgenstein had very little respect for such religion, he called it superstition. But he thought that actually most real religion wasn't like that. And in that thought he is followed today, for example, by Karen Armstrong and by John Gray. I don't know how many people heard John Gray's marvellous point of view on this on Radio 4 a couple of weeks ago, which you can probably still get on iPlayer. Religion is actually, to a large extent, a matter of practice rather than what philosophers and theologians call belief. It can be understood as a matter of belief, but only if you recharacterize what you understand belief as meaning in the kind of way that Wittgenstein and many of his followers have sought to do. So I would be extremely hesitant before diagnosing someone with a messiah complex or believing in a messiah as being deluded, let alone obviously deluded. I do think there is such a thing as delusion. I think that if I'm faced by somebody who is sufficiently far gone on a journey of psychosis, then I'm not going to seek to get them to confirm my diagnoses of them, because they're not in any position to do so. You know, it's not meaningful even really to ask such a person, you know, have I got right what you're saying or something. But until you reach that kind of extreme point, then I think the therapeutic prejudice, if you like, is an extremely productive one. And it doesn't mean you have to say so no one's in denial or whatever. What it means is you have to keep an open mind. You have to keep considering the possibility that it may be you rather than they that are wrong, or, and this is much more frequent, that you haven't succeeded fully in mutually understanding each other yet.
There are so many questions that have been opened up. I just want to follow through or think the notion of the affective, and the way that the affective is really important within a therapeutic practice.
Sorry, do you mean the affective?
Affective, yeah. And the way that when you talk about theoretical reason and Wittgenstein's critique of theoretical reason, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about where or how the notion of the affective comes into your sense of therapeutic. I want to give an example on that first point. Take the child in a school classroom, and take the child who's kind of subjected to a teacher who, in the teacher's his or her authority, tears up their work in front of the whole class. And in doing that, thinks that they're being responsible as a teacher. This is what their authority means that they do. The children in the classroom might feel, and I'm not a philosophy of education person, I'm a sociologist, the children in the classroom, if you did it now, might feel horror of what they experienced, of what they witnessed. But they might not be able to kind of articulate or understand what's happened in
yep.
that situation. Mm. Now, you might want to think, or I'd want to think, of the way that children might be philosophers.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, the impact of that...
They're on this rising part of the curve here already.
Okay, so yeah. The impact of that event might take a child out of years. So here I am teaching at Goldsmiths, and I've got my students. And a student who has difficulty in writing comes back and returns to this moment in her teaching as in primary school and begins to recognize through an engagement with me as a tutor how impactful that moment or that event was.
Yeah.
Now, it isn't, as first question, misconception. This conception is still within the terms of a kind of particular kind of theoretical reason. But it is in the place of the impact of that contact text where she doesn't necessarily understand, have the grammar, and only possibly through doing sociology have some understanding of how relationships of power operate in that situation. Now, why did he do that? Didn't he realise, and now she might have the language that was abusive, or there might be a language of the abuse of his or her power as a teacher. And there's a kind of reshaping of the experience that might come later that will allow, or could allow her, to carry on in writing. It might make a difference to her feeling of hesitation, her ease with which she would feel that she can express herself without this fear. Now, what it was fear. What became embodied through that action was a fear that was carried for 15 years. It was long-lasting. It was quite deeply set.
Yeah.
Now, that's where you might think, or I'd want to think, when someone says, well, her reflection on her own fear or difficulties of writing is or can be a philosophical reflection. So, where is philosophy? Can philosophy be in the classroom in that context? And how do we begin to think or develop, as you're beginning to do, emotional therapeutic, such that it can recognize the affective development that's taking place,
yeah.
Emotional development is right.
Yeah, lovely, thanks. Well, I'm not sure exactly what to say to that. I guess one thought I have is that, to me, it is absolutely obvious that any educational environment is a absolutely thoroughly and massively saturatedly affective environment. And if we don't take that seriously, we're bound to be ludicrously ineffective teachers. I guess one of the places I'm coming from in what I'm talking about here, about kind of suggesting this therapy object of comparison rather than the theory object of comparison, is to suggest that unless we remember that when we are teaching in a university classroom or engaging in a discussion like this, unless we remember that when we're doing philosophy or dealing with so-called educational theory and so on and so forth, then we're likely to sort of fail at the first base, because we're likely to carry forward by accident from a context which we might think of as a sort of master context, a context where we're reflecting, debating, dealing with theories, etc., carry forward from that context into the actual kind of, as it were, object context of an educational situation that involves children, assumptions that are unhelpful. So I guess part of the point that I'm trying to make is that, for example, I think it's really important in philosophical discussions that we don't get tied up, as we so often do get tied up, in thinking, well, what we're dealing with here, this is a purely intellectual matter. This is just a matter of kind of rationally sorting out what's going on. When already there's huge amounts of kind of fear and hope and various kinds of freighting, etc., in a room like this, then as it were, a fortiori, all of that is going to apply massively more strongly in a situation where you're teaching children whose degree of self-confidence, or whose moldability, or whose susceptibility to peer pressure, etc., is likely to be much higher than it is for many of us in this room here today.
Thank you. Richard.
All right. Let's try and do this. I think I defend science. So
good.
I wonder where to start. The description of the taxi driver and the guy walking around, it seems to me that the guy walking around is lost. The taxi driver does know where he's going because he's looked at the map. And it seems to me that you're not actually characterising philosophy or science as it's happening now. It seems to me it's very much a straw man. It seems to me that if you look at, say, contemporary work in ethics and philosophy of morals and so on and so forth, the range of resources that that kind of philosophy is using. Goes from novels to films through to scientific theories of the mind and consciousness to experimental philosophy. None of this seems to be anything like the kind of caricature of science that you're giving, which seems to me like a kind of almost like a positivist 1930s stereotype of a physicist. It really doesn't seem to hang with anything like the kind of stuff that's going on in the real philosophy departments where, if you like, scientism is going on. And I think there's a big difficulty with the position that you're taking. One is, as far back as Nietzsche, if you took, say, a kind of a modest sort of naturalism, what to take it would be a kind of scientism to you. As early as Nietzsche, you know, the rereading of Nietzsche by, say, somebody like Brian Leiter, who's in the Chicago Law School, so he's not a scientist, he's not doing it for that, he's looking at law, he's looking at ethics, he's looking at morals, as was Nietzsche. And Nietzsche, you know, made three big claims, which seem now, as the philosophers and the scientists and the psychologists and the psychiatrists get together, seem to be hanging together and seems to be raising all sorts of challenges for the kind of view that says we don't need to look at this. First thing is that you don't have free will. Second thing is that you don't know yourself. You don't have a transparent self. So there are things happening that are subterranean. You need to better find those out, or your kind of folk beliefs about yourself and yourself beliefs about yourself will be wrong. And thirdly, therefore, because of those theories, because of that, you can't have a universal morality because people are different. Now there's a case, and it seems to be picking up on what Michael was saying at the beginning. It seems like, okay, there might be some people who would be helped by therapy. Fine. But it seems to me that that's not really what philosophy is about. And it's not really about... And it doesn't seem to have anything to do in any kind of universal sense of characterising what the philosophers of science are doing, the philosophers of ethics are doing, art, theory, and so on and so forth. It seems to me it's kind of missing the point. I think the final thing would be that I think it's a bit strange to find that you're using philosophical investigations and the Tractatus as if they're saying the same thing. When Wittgenstein didn't think they were saying the same thing, he actually said, you know, he gave up philosophy after Tractatus because he thought it solved everything, and came back a few years later because he thought Tractatus was all wrong, and the philosophical investigations was the thing that got it right, which was the reverse of what he was saying in the first. But you've got it as the last three statements there. You were using as examples of the therapeutic approach, which actually was the philosophical investigation. So it seems to me that there's a whole bundle of stuff here. And just by bringing in things like, you know, research grants going to the scientists rather than the humanities, etc., which I think everybody would think that's a bad thing, it's not really the point of the issue, is it?
Okay, there's a lot there. We can go through it all, but it'll take a long time if we do. Let's start with that last little point. I didn't say research grants going to the sciences rather than the humanities. What I said is the model of research itself is scientific. Okay, that's a very important distinction. In terms of the point about the two Wittgensteins, well, of course, what you've given us is the standard view, and many people still hold that view, and many people now don't. And if you don't know about the alternative, I would urge you to look into it. Do have a read of this, or have a read of the new Wittgenstein. Look into what people are saying now, because what people are saying now is that the view of the so-called two Wittgensteins has been a radical oversimplification. As I make clear in my essay in this, there's nobody who's saying the early Wittgenstein, later Wittgenstein were the same. But what we're saying is that actually there's a deep commonality and continuity that's been completely missed, and that you can't really understand the later philosophy, let alone the earlier philosophy, if you don't start to take that thought seriously. The thought, as we put it in the introduction to the new Wittgenstein, that there is a therapeutic strand that runs throughout Wittgenstein's work, at least from the Tractatus onwards. In terms of naturalism, no, I'm not opposed to all naturalism. It all depends what we mean by naturalism. I would advocate what's sometimes called a kind of deflationary naturalism, which I think is what Wittgenstein and, to some extent, Dewey advocate. What my problem is with scientific naturalism, which is, I think, increasingly dominant in philosophy, the kind of naturalism that you have in one form in Kripke and another form in Quine, and that's what I'm wanting to oppose. You accuse me of being against various straw men. Well, possibly, but I did give quite a lot of examples, or at least like quite a lot of names of the folk that I was meaning to oppose in the course of the talk, and I don't think that many of them are straw men. For example, I'm meaning to oppose some important strands in the tradition of philosophy of mind and psychology, which is now extremely influential, that comes down to us from Chomsky. I gave as a specific example my opposition to theory of mind theory. That's not just 1950s positivism, that's here and now, and it's extremely dominant. In terms of your points about the taxi driver, I don't think you understood very well what I was meaning to say there.
Okay, all right.
You said the thing about, you expressed skepticism about the passage I read from Wittgenstein, I think. You said that person is just lost. But what Wittgenstein is trying to do is give you an idea of how you can get to know somewhere without getting to know somewhere as you get to know somewhere by reading a map. Getting to know somewhere by actually knowing your way about, such that, for example, you might, as it were, feel in your body that it's a right turn at this junction. And I think that's quite an interesting and important distinction. In terms of the material from Nietzsche, well, I'm a big fan of Nietzsche, and a lot of what Nietzsche says is right on the button with what I'm saying here, for example. And Flipberg makes quite a lot of those aspects of Nietzsche in his wonderful book. But we do have to be quite careful with Nietzsche, I think. So, for example, Nietzsche's point about no free will, this is, of course, an extremely drastic and crude oversimplification. The question of whether or not we have free will, a sort of eternal philosophical question, that to answer it definitively one way or another, yes we do or no we don't, is always, in my view, a gross mistake. In terms of Nietzsche's very important point about our not having self-knowledge, but I would agree, but the question is, how is one to think about what self-knowledge is? And that's what I was trying to talk about early on in the talk, and my suggestion was that the dominant picture of what self-knowledge is, picture self-knowledge as a subset of knowledge. And following Wittgenstein, I think this is a radically mistaken view, a sort of mythologically mistaken view, and that it's a disaster to think of the mind as a sort of inner realm as compared to the world, which is an outer realm. And that's why I advocated a therapeutic conception of self-knowledge. And I mentioned, of course, the way in which this goes back to Freud. In this regard, I think we can see Freud helpfully as a successor to an improver of Nietzsche, in the sense that what Freud was seeking to do was to understand how it could become possible for people to actually achieve a greater self-knowledge. And Freud proposed a practice in which this could become possible, which was not something which Nietzsche did to any very, very great degree. I think that Freud is a great inheritor of and improver of Nietzsche, although, as I said earlier, there's also vast problems in Freud because of his own massive fall into scientism. And finally, just to give another example of the kind of thing that I was meaning to try to do when I was juxtaposing these voices that I'm recommending, these broadly therapeutic voices, by contrast with scientistic voices, which I think are otherwise rather dominant in our culture. To come back to the question earlier of delusion, it's very important to understand how someone like me, following Louis Sass, is using this term delusion. For me, a delusion is not a false belief, right? A false belief is something very, very straightforward and simple. A delusion has an altogether more elusive character. If you actually look carefully at the nature of the form of thinking, speaking, experiencing of many persons with psychosis, for example, you find that it's far, far too crude and simple to say, well, they have false beliefs. They err in their reality testing. Because, for example, they will... someone with a system of paranoid delusions, for example, will express all sorts of views about how the CIA are following them, or how they're a king but nobody recognizes them as a king, and so on and so forth. But in various important respects, they will not act on those beliefs. In other words...
Just
yeah.
An example of the kind of experiment that is going on now. So... Somebody like Carruthers could have set up your talk tonight and put half of us in the other room and kept us in hell, but instructed the ones in the other room to nod all the way through whilst listening to you on a video. And everybody in here instructed to shake their heads. And then when asked, the people in the other room would have all agreed, most of them would have agreed, and most of the people in here would have disagreed or not liked it. Now there's a lot of evidence that that kind of thing happens. Mm-hmm. Now it seems to me that needs and then theories, you know, there are some theories then come as to why the people were asked to nod through the talk liked it.
Do we really need a theory to explain that?
Well, the thing
isn't it just obvious?
Well, the thing they do, because and well, again, whether they need it or not, what you're not saying they don't need it. What you're saying is you shouldn't even think of theorizing it. That seems to be what the therapy is saying. So the argument is not about whether you can or you should. It's about whether you should or you shouldn't, not whether you can or you can't. And you're saying you shouldn't. Now, the argument that they would say is, look, you might have a very good point, and that's fine, but why shouldn't we theorize? What's the damage in finding out that actually there's some evolutionary thing that's useful to explain the kind of trigger things that allows us to be self-deluded, and then start discussing the different theories? Because they're not just what, there's hundreds of people. And then what I'm suggesting is that the kind of answer there is very nuanced. It's not just either or.
Okay, thanks. I guess that to some degree I am saying you shouldn't theorize. I'm saying that as in various domains. I'm saying that as a corrective to a dominant view. I gave various reasons in the talk for why I think that, the sort of Dreyfusardian, Flivbergian reasons, among others. But look, the really crucial thing that I'm trying to do here is not that. I'd be prepared to give that up if necessary. The really crucial thing that I'm trying to do here is to say there are other possibilities. And my terrible fear about scientism and the stranglehold that it has over so much, for example, of the academic world, is that it drives out those possibilities and tends to say, no, the only legitimate kind of thing to do is to theorize and attempt to prove your theory true and false, etc. And I've offered some reasons for thinking that that's not a good thing to try to do in relation to vast tranches of human life, not all. But the really important point that I'm making, the point that I would urge people to take away with them if they think there's anything valid in what I'm saying today, is the thought that there is an alternative. We're not forced into having to theorize and find respectability within the so-called scientific worldview.
Paul.
Thank you, Lise. I'd just like to ask you about the term therapy, which I don't want to make too much of it, but you put it in inverted commas in your title. And then, of course, therapy can take different forms, so that if I pull a muscle, I go and see the physiotherapist, and she treats me for a few months, and then it's better, and I never have the problem again. I never even think about it after that. But I may go and see my psychoanalyst, who's been used to dealing with me for a number of years, and we both kind of understand that we'll carry on doing this because it's a way of living with my neuroses. And it's not that I'm specially neurotic, this is just part of the human condition to be neurotic. And so in that sense, the aim of the therapy or what we're doing with it is rather different. One leads to a solution which resolves the problem, and the other one rather adjusts us to it.
Yeah.
Okay. So that would be part of the question, because you tend to use the word in a monolithic kind of way. And I get the feeling, admittedly, from a fairly short paper that you've circulated before, that it's a steady progress towards improvement. Whereas I wonder in Wittgenstein if it's a bit more troubled than you're making out.
Thanks for that, Paul. No, I definitely think it's often troubled. Which is why I tend to, as I did in this talk, when I give kind of actual sort of specific examples, tend to use examples from psychotherapy, etc., rather than physiotherapy. I do think that there are some cases in which one can find genuine analogues for the first kind of case, the physiotherapy kind of case in philosophy, but they tend to be the easy bits. Correcting some kind of sort of repeated sort of tick derived from some particular kind of misunderstanding, rather than dealing with the kind of thing that comes up again and again and again, and even when we think we've dealt with it, we find out, you know, a month down the road or a minute down the road or something that we haven't. So I think actually we're probably pretty close on this question. The reason why the term therapeutic is in inverted commas in the title of the talk is that, of course, this idea of therapy is itself just one more therapeutic object of comparison. It doesn't have any special privileged status. I'm not saying, for example, Wittgenstein's philosophy is therapy. It literally is, and that's all it is. I'm rather saying you can get a really good picture of what Wittgenstein's philosophy is by using this example, which is actually a whole series of sort of potential examples and ideas of therapy. That's a good object to set aside what we do in philosophy, and not just in philosophy. It ramifies into many areas of human endeavor and knowledge, much less so in the actual sciences. Another term which I'm using increasingly, and which will be in one of my upcoming books, is the idea of liberation, which I also mentioned a couple of times, which is sort of related with different object comparison. Therapy, if it's done right, is liberatory, but the idea of liberation can also be broader. But just because you've been liberated from something at a point in your life doesn't mean you won't be captured by it again a little bit later.
Do you think he holds that thought both at the stage of the Tractatus and at the stage of the Investigations? Because in the Tractatus he talks about the final solution in the preface. And later on, I mean, I think you're right to say he turns his attention to the variety of problems that keep coming up and troubling us.
Yeah.
He also talks about dissolving problems rather than solving them. And I'm a bit curious about resolution, the resolute in relation to this trajectory as well.
Yeah, I think you have to read the preface of the Tractatus with great care, and we could go into that, but it's probably not the best thing to do right now. What I do think is that the really important thing about the Tractatus is that there's a really important sense in which the Tractatus, just like Wittgenstein's later work, is a kind of a book which is actually a kind of stand-in for something which is not a book, namely a much more kind of extended, open-ended, in a certain sense, as you were implying, endless kind of dialogical process. I think that Wittgenstein certainly did not think at the time when he wrote the Tractatus that it was possible to simply read the Tractatus from the beginning to the end, and then you would arrive at the final solution of all your philosophical problems. I think he thought what you would have to do is read it, and then reread it, and then keep reading parts of it, and then start applying some of the ideas in it for yourself, and carrying them on in a new way, and sort of coming back and forth to the sentences of the Tractatus, seeing how, in the way I gestured at in relation to 6.37, you could leave more and more of them behind in a sort of vaguely sort of Dreyfus kind of manner. And that, I think, is a quintessentially therapeutic and dialogical process.
John?
Just a couple of questions to clarify.
Just one last point. And that's, I think, part of what Wittgenstein means in the preface to the Tractatus when he says, this is not a textbook. Sorry.
Just some questions to clarify my mind. First of all, who your parents are, and who your friends are. I think in the list of names you gave, you included Rawls, which I was slightly puzzled by. So my first question is why you mentioned him, and whether that was in virtue of his attempt to theorise about justice, or whether it was in virtue of the particular kind of theorising he engaged in, whether that, what was objection about that, the scope of the type of activities that he involved. So that's one question about Rawls.
Yeah.
You didn't mention Weeks, which didn't surprise me, because, for example, it was known actively towards attempts to provide theory in ethics. So I wondered if you could just say a bit about your attitude towards Williams' way of going about ethics. And entirely separate to that question, could you just say a little bit more about the conditions under which you would think a person as having made a mistake or going wrong? And how that's connected to a view about competence on the part of that person, and how you conceive competence.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Right, on Williams, yeah, I am. I'm not a sort of Williamsian, but I'm not against Williams either, for the kind of reason that you gave. Maybe Vlad would like to comment on Williams, who he knows far, far better Williams' work than I do. I always used to enjoy talking with Williams, precisely because of his of the non theoretical way, as I saw it, with which he approached so many issues. But I never entirely knew what to sort of take away from him, if you know what I mean, and how to go on at the end of the day.
He did say, though, yes, I know that. He did say, though, didn't he, notably,
philosophy had better include a conception of getting it right, or not bother at all.
Yes, well, I've still got an entrepreneurial therapeutic conception, a conception of getting it right, only it's a kind of moving target, and it is to some extent person relative. So that's the difference there. In terms of rules, yes, you've correctly intuited the kind of reasons that make me antipathetic to rules, both his overarching theoretical architectonic and the actual way in which he proceeds in the details of that theorization. One moment in rules with which I'm particularly unhappy is the way that rules starts out a theory of justice right on the first page by saying that the first virtue of political institutions is justice, just as the first virtue of theories is truth. And that's a kind of modelling of what he's doing directly on a kind of a particular kind of standard kind of vision of science and epistemology and truth. And I think that's extremely unfortunate and sends Rawls off immediately in a wrong direction. I think this happened partly because Rawls was very influenced by people around him at Harvard, strikingly by Quine, whose influence you can see at a couple of crucial moments in footnotes and so on in the Theory of Justice. And Quine is one of these scientific naturalists who I'm setting myself up against. In terms of your other point about competence and mistakes, I don't know, we could spend an awful lot of time talking about this. Obviously, the key point which I went over a few times to do with therapy is that there's this essential kind of coming back to the person's own assent. But that, of course, and this is perhaps what you were where you're coming from, depends on some kind of level of being able to ascribe competence, being able to be somewhere sort of up here rather than down here. How is one going to judge that? Well, I don't have anything terribly sophisticated to say about that. It's things like a person being socially competent, linguistically competent, etc. Of course, an important point to make here, if one's going into detail about this, and Dreyfus makes this point, is that competence is not the same thing as excellence. And we can always get better at social arts, and we can always get better in our linguistic competence, and we can always get better in our in our level of ethical behavior and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't want to give the impression that as soon as you arrive at something which is worth calling competence, you can just stop and not try to improve yourself any further. On the contrary, I'm another of the reasons why I'm not happy with Rawls's philosophy is that I'm actually very sympathetic to a sort of perfectionist approach to ethics, and I think that we should strive always for excellence rather than competence. What is a mistake? Again, I don't think I have got anything terribly profound to say. I think we all know what mistakes are and what competence is. I think this is exactly the kind of thing that comes back to the fundamental starting point of people like Winch and Garfinkel. These are not matters that need to be theorized. We're always already all basically familiar with them, I'd suggest. I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer.
Just one comment if I may.
Very brief, yes.
On competence, you were also a divinity. I presume that somebody such as myself would count as broadly competent in, according to some sort of conception we have. And yet in respect to most of the philosophical problems that I try rather freely to think about, I consider myself, I think for some reason, to be pretty incompetent. I don't mean not excellent, I mean incompetent. And that's partly a reflection on me, and it's partly a reflection on the complexity, difficulty of the problems that
Yeah, you know the famous Buddhist story of the philosopher who comes to have tea with a, I think it's a Zen master, and the philosopher says, oh, this is going to be so brilliant, I'm going to learn loads of stuff from you, and we're going to have great dialogues, and the philosopher's talking, and the Zen master is smiling, and and pouring the cup of tea for the philosopher, and the philosopher goes on talking and talking and doesn't notice that all the tea is pouring out over the table, and then doesn't notice until it pours over onto his lap. So what the hell are you doing? And stops. And the Zen master says, look, we can't get anywhere at all until you empty your own cup. So you think you're philosophically incompetent, but what I think is that unfortunately very many professional philosophers who are extremely clever people and know a vaster amount about their subject in the terms of the moves that are made and what people have said about it and so on and so forth, are singularly lacking in wisdom and understanding of all the things that are most important. And I'm not sure I would prefer most of them to you in terms of if anything hung on the answers that they were to give to a philosophical question. If it actually mattered, you know, I'd probably take your judgment over theirs half the time.
But you don't know John.
I don't know, but he seems very nice. And he seems a bit more humble than most of them.
The fellow at the back, who knows about Williams?
I want to kind of re-ask the last two questions, but not with a view to pressing anything intellectually, but with a view to mapping where you want to be.
Yeah.
I think that there has obviously got to be a very large space for philosophers and social scientists who are neither scientistic nor therapeutic. And because we've been talking about this dichotomy, I wanted to bring in that group. And I wanted to ask you how you think of that group, how big you think it is.
Can you tell us a bit more about who's in the group or what kind of group it is?
Well, the group is just a derivation from the idea that however you cut scientism, there are going to be a lot of folks who are not going to be scientists, who aren't therapeutic either. I mean, that's not where we end up, and we have an idiotic idea of scientism. So in the social sciences, it might be philosophers like Charles Taylor and Alistair MacIntyre.
Yeah, okay, good, yeah. Yes.
In a certain sense, but it would be examples from philosophy. How big do you see that? And do you give them the tag of being legitimately non-scientistic? And do you see them more as friends or foes? And how do you see dialogue between you and them going on? So it's broad, and I'm more interested in culture wars and mapping than in intellectual disputes. So how do you position yourself vis-a-vis these folks?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's a good question. And you're right. I wouldn't characterize people like MacIntyre and Taylor and indeed Williams as, although Williams is a stranger case, but certainly MacIntyre and Taylor I wouldn't characterize as either straight down the line scientistic or therapeutic thinkers, absolutely. I would say that I do believe that there is a therapeutic dimension to the philosophy of many philosophers who one doesn't standardly think of as therapeutic philosophers. So I mentioned, for example, some of the ancient Stoics, some of the ancient skeptics, Socrates himself. I would also mention people such as Barclay, Nietzsche, Marx even. I would claim that there is a huge swathe of scientism in Marx, but when you eliminate that, there is also an important therapeutic dimension of his work. For example, you can see this quite clearly, I think, in relation to what he does in relation to the concept of the commodity, and I've written about this. But yes, there's other stuff as well. For example, quite a lot of doing history in the right way, I think, is just sort of orthogonal to the kind of discussions we've been having here this afternoon. And quite a lot of what's good in people like MacIntyre and Taylor is a certain kind of sort of doing history, if you like, sort of philosophical history. Yeah, there is. I was certainly not meaning to imply that that the sort of dichotomy that I was working with is at all exhaustive. Absolutely not. Another reason, of course, why it's not exhaustive is because there's also science. And science is absolutely fine, right? I'm quite happy with science. My only concern is with the aping of science, where there isn't actual science. So that's another vast tranche of human knowledge that I have no problem with at all. Does that help?
It does, sure. I mean, just a brief follow-up. I suppose one way of categorizing some of these folks, like Mark Tower, would be to say that they oppose reductionism in the sense of relating naturalistic and non-naturalistic understanding, but they favor continuity. In other words, they would probably run an account of the way all our understandings of ourselves ought to be continuous with our best naturalistic understanding of ourselves that might be compatible with the therapeutic approach.
Yeah, I hope it wouldn't be. As I mentioned, I'm quite happy if people wish to attribute it to me to accept the label of a deflationary naturalist. And I absolutely do not want to get into competition with any genuinely scientific results, of which I think there are very, very many. And some of them, for example, are given in McGilchrist's book, and some of them are given in Sass's book, and some of them are present. Different kinds of stuff are present in the ideas of what kind of animal the human animal is in the work of somebody like McIntyre. I'm a big fan of his book Dependent Rational Animals, for example. So yes, it would be misleading if I've given the... I wouldn't want, for example, to be assimilated to those broadly postmodernist thinkers who have some kind of fantasy of thinking that the understanding, the correct way to understand human beings can operate from some kind of quasi-blank slate type idea of thinking that we spin ourselves completely out of our own historical development without this being vastly constrained by all kinds of things that that genuine sciences are interested in.
Michael, mention of philosophical history is quite useful to the question I had, because when you claim that Wittgenstein's philosophy to be one of unknowing.
Yeah.
The term unknowing. And at one point you said scientism and modernism are both horrifically knowing.
Postmodernism.
Postmodernism, yeah. Okay. Okay, but clearly there's a strong contrast intended. And just
a lot of modernism as well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Not all.
If you agreed on the term postmodernism. But anyway, the point is to do with the term unknowing.
Yeah.
And to do with the gesture one could make, and McIntyre's in play here, and he's, I don't know if you'd agree quite so much with his more recent book on the legacy of the Catholic University, because the point I want to make really is to do with the sort of negative theological conception of unknowing. Because if you make a kind of pre-modern gesture, and I'm thinking specifically of a book, a text by Nicholas of Cusa, from 1460, called De Docta Ignorantia, or as it's sometimes translated, On Learned Ignorance. And so, I mean, you've mentioned, you know, these various sort of Zen Buddhist stories and things like that to kind of indicate what you might mean. But in there is, of course, in Western thought, one could, of course, say that this is pre- a certain conception of science, you know, and therefore obviously pre-scientism, but one can make the gesture to a pre-modern sort of axis in order to get a conception of unknowing which doesn't necessarily jump out the sort of cultural context, and possibly does even give you those sort of other possibilities beyond scientism that you were explaining to do with the term therapeutic. So it's really just doing
that
notion of situating the term unknowing.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, well, there's quite a lot of Catholic theology which I'm pretty unhappy with. I'll come straight out and say that.
I don't
follow McIntyre all the way down that one of his various roads. Definitely not. As indicated in our discussion earlier about Wittgenstein and religion, this is one of the dimensions along which I'm sympathetic with Wittgenstein and with this idea of unknowing. I'm afraid I'm not familiar with the de Cusa text in question. I do know a little about de Cusa, but mostly from his astronomical work, rather than the area you're talking about. So I'm not sure how much. I'm just not sure how much kind of profitable ground for interaction or further exploration there is here. Although it's something I'm interested in. I'm actually reading some of this medieval kind of mystical literature and so on at the moment. So maybe we can talk about it in a year's time or something.
Jake.
I was wondering about your paper in relation to education. So you had mentioned that essentially what you applied to the lab was just to reaffirm that sort of scientific type knowledge is not the only type of knowledge that we get to know, or it's not the only route to knowledge as well. So how does that or would that affect the aims of education, especially, say, the more sort of liberal aims of being autonomy, opponent of intellect, or anything like that? Do those change? Would you be more championing an aim of education of more self-knowledge, self-awareness, but the self-awareness that is, you know, as you said, eliciting the postulates, that kind of knowledge? And if that's the case, then you had mentioned that sort of these things require humility and courage, which for me is more, it kind of strikes me as then more of almost a virtue type situation.
Yeah.
So then would you be more championing of a character or virtue education? I mean, I don't know if you can answer these things, but I don't know.
Well, thank you very much for the question, and I think you're tuning in quite nicely to the kinds of things that I think about these things, yes. I think it would be good to have more philosophy in children's education. I think it would be good for children's education to be more generally, philosophically touched in the kind of understanding of philosophy that I'm offering here. Not the kind which is in fact dominant. So while on the one hand I say it'd be great to have more philosophy for children, on the other hand it would depend quite a lot on what that philosophy was like, whether it would actually be great or not. I'm very sympathetic to Ivan Illich's thoughts about education, and I think the kind of line that I'm taking here is pretty strongly compatible with thinking about how to try to somewhat de-school society, beginning with schools, I think that's really important. In that sense, I think that education can be and should be genuinely far more liberatory. However, I wouldn't want to move to too quick an identification of that with the idea of a liberal education, because I'm actually ironically somewhat skeptical of the idea of a liberal education. Why am I skeptical of that idea? Because I think that the problem with the idea of a liberal education, as it is very often presented, is some kind of fantasy of complete neutrality in the way that that education is delivered, and simply sort of allowing the child or the student at university, as in liberal arts colleges in the States, to kind of find their own solution, and some kind of notion that whatever solution they find could be right or right for them or something. I think there's a dangerous tendency to cultural relativism implicit in the idea of a liberal education, if that's what the idea of liberal education is. When I teach, when I myself teach, I try to do it in a liberatory way, but I don't try to do it in what I call a liberal way. In other words, I don't, for example, pretend that I, as the teacher, am a neutral authority delivering a body of knowledge. On the contrary, I try to enter into an agonistic relation with students. I emphasize repeatedly that I'm not offering them a neutral point of view, but I'm offering them a very distinctive point of view. I try, obviously, to engage with them therapeutically in the ways that have been presented in this here this evening. And I actually think that that's the only way in which one can be genuinely liberatory. I think there is an incompatibility between the pretense of liberal neutrality, which is, again, of course, one of the reasons why I don't like Rawls's thinking very much, on the one hand, and the actual goal of liberation and the goals which are implicit in therapy, on the other hand. I think that liberality in that sense, or liberalness, is incompatible with being liberatory. And the way that one can actually liberate one's students as a teacher includes facilitating their recognition of you as, on the one hand, somebody who may have experience which they're not privy to, that may have thought through things they haven't thought through, etc., 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 but on the other hand, is not simply to be trusted or taken as an authority.
Go on, quick follow-up.
Because the whole self-knowledge and liberation and therapy, I think, is important.
Yeah.
Is the role of responsibility within that, especially personal responsibility? Because if we talked about, you know, our delusions or our neuroses, and we have to get to our own truths, and our truths are the ones to be recognized and things like that. That takes courage and humility, accepting all of that stuff. But for me, it takes one step further. That's taking responsibility.
That's absolutely. Yeah, totally agree. Because it's terribly easy when you're, as it were, in the position of being the client in therapy to be irresponsible. Right? It's terribly easy to just kind of insist, no, you know, I'm not going to acknowledge anything that you say, etc., etc. And one can stay in that position indefinitely. Of course, it doesn't profit one anything. One doesn't learn anything, one doesn't grow, etc., etc. But it's a position that is kind of structurally open, given the structure of the therapeutic criterion of truth, as I called it. So, for there to be the possibility of genuine therapy, there has to be, obviously, responsibility on the part of the therapist, but also responsibility taken on the part of the client, or the therapee, or whatever you want to call the other position, the patient. Without such responsibility, there can't be any progress, growth, learning, etc. If the other is not in a position to take such responsibility, then one needs to try to undertake movements to put them into such a position. Very young children are not in such a position, and nor are people in certain kinds of extremes of psychopathological delusion. But hopefully, most of us, most of the time, are. But, you know, it's kind of an open question. It is, I think, one of the wonderful things about this model, is that it sort of puts the ball in everyone's court and says, right, come on, let's see, how good can you be? How well can you do this? How much are you prepared to rise to this challenge? So it's an invitation to us all, in that sense, to be our best. And you know, what could be more important?
I'm going to call it a day. Thank you very much for an extremely stimulating paper and for your very thoughtful responses to our questions.
That's
and
a great thank you question. So some of us are going for a drink now?
Yes, indeed. We are heading down to the bar downstairs in the basement for a pint if anybody would like to come and join us. Sure.